I used to work for a private investigations firm called AIS. AIS stood for Atlas Investigative Solutions, and at the time, they were probably the most highly regarded PI firm in the UK. They only hired ex-military and former police officers, and even then, they didn't just accept any old tosser. They invited you for an interview, talked about your service record and your credentials, and they were very thorough. They wanted the best, and in return they offered extremely generous wage packets. In 1991, an old pal of mine had received a call from one of their recruitment officers, not long after the pair of us had been discharged from the army. But since he'd promised to be much more family-oriented post-discharge, he turned the role down in favor of a local 9-to-5. But knowing I was a single bloke and one more interested in padding my bank account than living the easy life, he put me in touch with the recruiter. I should tell you right now that about 60-70% of private detective jobs are extremely boring. AIS might have been one of the most reliable and well-respected firms in the UK, but it didn't mean that we were all off playing 007. The majority of our clients were upper-middle-class professional types, with the occasional celebrity or member of high society putting in a request for some discreet information gathering. But the kinds of jobs we did for that lot were, for the most part, the same as any other type of people. Only instead of sitting in a car on a council estate waiting for someone's secret lover to turn up at a block of flats, you were sitting in a car outside some fancy three-story Victorian manor waiting for someone's secret lover to turn up in a Rolls Royce. The only difference was the location. But what were fairly unique to the upper classes were what we at AIS used to call non-vulnerable missing persons cases. I personally dealt with half a dozen separate cases involving kids of wealthy parents going missing. But I use that term very loosely because 9 times out of 10, they were just going through a bit of a rebellious period and had run away from home. One girl ran off to live in an all-vegan commune in Hackney. The police went and found her, but she didn't want to go home, and since she was newly 18, there was nothing they could do about it. As long as she wasn't breaking the law, she was free to do as she pleased. But that didn't wash with Mummy and Daddy. They wanted to know where their little girl was, so we'd tail them, keep tabs on them, hack their phones, all sorts, and their parents would be shelling out tens of thousands every week for the privilege. Like I said, I must have worked 6 or 7 of those jobs just on my own, so when I was informed there was a missing persons case up for grabs, I thought it'd just be more the same. But then, right away, I could tell this one was going to be different. The clients were based in my native Scotland, in a wee village called Crossley, near Glasgow, and this is partly why I was offered the job in the first place. I thought that, since they were paying big money to have their missing person found, they'd be living in some country house with a Range Rover sitting out front. But I was wrong. They weren't in poverty or anything. They obviously led a relatively comfortable life. But they weren't anywhere near the class of client that I was used to dealing with at AIS, nor was their missing person some spoiled brat who'd run off with their dad's credit card. What they were was desperate. The missing person they wanted tracking was their son, a 21-year-old up-and-coming boxer who, for the sake of his family's anonymity, I'll refer to only as Robbie. After he'd first gone missing, his parents had reported it to the police, but after months upon months of investigation, the case hadn't gotten anywhere. But it wasn't like they made a bit of progress. Questioned a few suspects, and then the leads just dried up. Robbie's parents said officers had been met with a complete wall of silence. No one had seen him, no one had spoke to him, and it was like he just walked out of his parents' house and disappeared into thin air. By the time I was called onto the job, a campaign set up by local volunteers had just run out of funding, with Renfrewshire Police having only one officer working on the case and only on a sporadic basis at that. Robbie's parents then managed to collect enough in cash donations to get AIS involved, which I can promise you was no small feat. And that's where I entered the picture. The first thing I did was get all the background information on the case, which included a fairly intimate profile of the missing person. Usually speaking, people that go missing have had something go wrong in their lives, be it drink, drugs, infidelity, or some other kind of addiction that either results in big debts or even bigger mistakes. But Robbie's parents insisted that he wasn't involved in anything like that at all. He never drank, he never smoked. He was religious about his diet. Everything in his life seemed to revolve around his potential career as a professional boxer. He kept himself out of trouble, and had even gotten himself a job at a local pub so he could save up some money to move to Glasgow, where he'd have access to some of the best boxing gyms in Scotland. What I'm trying to say is, there was no obvious warning signs with this young man at all. Not until I asked if there had been any sudden changes, or if he'd met anyone new in the weeks or months prior. Robbie's mum told me that there was something she told the police very early on in the investigation that she felt they'd overlooked. They asked her the same question about the new people appearing in Robbie's life before he disappeared, and this is what she told them. One evening, in the days just prior to his disappearance, Robbie had received a telephone call from someone his mum didn't recognize. This is back when a family tended to have just one large telephone, which was usually kept in a fairly communal space. For young lads like Robbie, there was no such thing as privacy when it came to telephone calls, so when the phone rang that evening, his mum was the first to pick it up. She thought that she knew the voices of all her son's friends and trainers. He was a popular young lad and got a lot of calls from the likes of friends, coaches, teammates, and training partners, but his mum always asked who was calling and made patter with them any time they'd call back. She knew a great many of them by voice or demeanor, but she didn't recognize the man who called that evening, and when she asked, the man simply told her, "I'm calling from the pub." He didn't give a name, he didn't sound particularly friendly either, he just asked for Robbie. His mum called him to the phone, and after a brief conversation, Robbie thanked the caller and hung up, but not before addressing him with the name Tony. Robbie's mum had never heard him mention anyone called Tony, and that immediately struck her as unusual. Like I said, she thought she knew pretty much everyone in her son's life. She even knew most of the people he worked at the pub with, along with the names of a few regulars, because Robbie would often come home and chat about his shifts with her. He'd mentioned his boss and a few of his colleagues by name. He even had special nicknames for some of the regulars who came in. But at no point had he ever mentioned anyone named Tony, and if they were close enough that Tony was calling him at home, she found it very strange that he'd never mentioned him before. Robbie's mum had mentioned this to the police not once, not twice, but on three separate occasions, and each time, they told her the lead was a dead end. No one called Tony worked at the pub. None of the regular patrons recognized the name, and in the end, the police told her it was an insignificant detail, and they were taking their investigation in a different direction. Robbie's mum said that at the time, she accepted their decision, but as time went by, it started to bother her more and more, and it bothered me, too. To me, the Tony-shaped piece of the puzzle wasn't a dead end. It was a loose end. The Tony thing wasn't the only loose end, because from what I learned, the whole pub angle had been completely overlooked. Robbie had been due to work that night, but he never made it to the pub, and the police decided whatever caused his disappearance occurred during the 30-minute walk between his home and his place of work. I understand why the police focused on that one stretch of road, canvassing nearby houses for any potential witnesses, and why they only saw the pub as a place to gather information. But to me, it was definitely something we needed to take another look at, especially since the pub and this mysterious Tony character seemed to be connected in some capacity. After talking to as many of Robbie's friends as I could reach, which I'd initially thought would be my primary path of inquiry, I decided to move on to the pub. But I couldn't just walk in, declare myself a private investigator, and expect people to give up previously undisclosed information. Instead, I'd have to set myself up as an unremarkable publican so I could gather as much information as I could, as covertly as I could. The money Robbie's parents raised had bought them 2 weeks' worth of my time. So knowing I'd be spending a lot of time in the pub he used to work in, I moved from Glasgow Travel Lodge that I was staying in to a small bed and breakfast within walking distance. Then over the next few days, I started showing my face around the pub. My cover story was that I was a recently divorced dad of two who was staying in a cheap bed and breakfast nearby while trying to get back on my feet again. That way, it made sense for me to be hanging around the pub all day, nursing pints and maybe putting a few quid on a horse race or two while I was there. It was that kind of lower-end country pub. Pints, pies, and the odd punts from the compulsive gamblers sat in their wee corners clutching the racing papers. and as much as I hate to say it, I actually fit right in. Having spent so long in the army, I was used to hanging around a dodgy pub or two, and being perched on a bar stool nursing a few pints was probably the best time on the job I've ever had. It was actually quite a good laugh at times. The bar staff and regulars seemed like decent folk, but still, I kept my mind on the job and did as much listening as I could. I popped in and out for a few days. A pint around lunchtime, one in the late afternoon, then I'd usually head back in the early evening when it was busiest. By my fifth day, I was getting quite a warm welcome from some of the regulars, and even the moody-faced barman seemed to soften up a bit. They were obviously getting quite comfortable with me, which suited me loads because it meant that I could start asking the odd question without ruffling anyone's feathers. But as it turns out, I didn't need to ask any to hear Tony's name being mentioned. I was sat there, Thursday night, pretending to watch whatever football they had on the telly, when this scruffy-looking bloke in a green parka walks into the pub. He says hello to one or two people, but only in passing as he walks straight up to the bar with a very serious look on his face. He ends up standing right next to me as he gets the barman's attention, but then thinking that he's just going to put in a drink order, the barman just looks at him as he's pouring a pint as if to say, "What are you having?" The scruffy bloke then shakes his head, beckons him over, and then asks him, "Is Tony going to be in tonight?" He didn't whisper it by any means, but he clearly didn't want to broadcast his question to the whole pub. The only trouble was, he was saying it right next to the one person who had a vested interest in overhearing him, and as you can imagine, the second I heard that name, my ears pricked up. The guy asked after Tony, and in a similarly muted voice, the barman told him that Tony would be by later on that evening. The scruffy guy then asked the barman to pass on an apology to Tony if he saw him first. The barman just replied, "Save it. I'm not the one you've got to impress." And the way he said it, it was like his scruffy acquaintance was on the way to the gallows. After the quiet scolding from the barman, the scruffy fellow scuttled out of the pub looking very, very worried. And right away, I'm beginning to get an idea of who this Tony guy is, but again, I've changed his name to protect the innocent. He was obviously someone people were afraid of, which meant that Robbie's mom had no idea how right to be concerned she really was. Having heard Tony was stopping by later that night, I finished my pint, then ducked out for a few hours to eat something, neck a few cups of coffee, and generally sober up a bit so I'd be fit to work. A few hours later, I was back on that very same bar stool, eyes peeled for anyone who even looked like they might be Tony. I was halfway through my second pint and becoming increasingly worried that the barman's tip might have been incorrect, when in walks a bloke that looked as wide as he was tall. He's got this massive gold watch on, all kinds of rings, a gold chain around his neck. He's obviously got a few quid and he doesn't mind showing it off either. He also looked like he'd spent most of his life lifting weights and not without a bit of help from the pharmacist, if you catch my drift. I had to wait until he got to the bar before I got actual confirmation, but as he strode through the bar, the way everyone looked at him behind his back told me everything I needed to know. He gets to the bar and I hear, "You all right, Tony?" from the barman. Tony orders a Guinness, takes a seat down the bar for me, and then he and the barman start talking in low voices. But then this time, because the pub is in a wee bit busier state and they're further down the bar, I have no idea what they're saying. I got the feeling that I was missing out on something I wanted to hear, but then again, I wanted everything that came out of his bloody mouth. So I stayed put, kept my eyes forward, and tried to pick up on what I could, which, sadly, wasn't very much. But then, after finishing his pint of Guinness, I heard Tony tell the barman, "See you Sunday." Then off he went. I kept up my cover, and popped in over the Friday and Saturday just to keep up appearances. Then comes Sunday, I was in the pub from the moment the doors opened, waiting for Tony to show up again. He walks in just after 3, plants himself at the bar, then asks the barman to put the boxing channel on after ordering his pint of Guinness. The barman does as he's told right away, then for the next few minutes, Tony's glued to the TV above the bar, riveted by whatever boxing highlights were playing. Now, I happen to know a thing or two about boxing, enough to be able to use it as a means of striking up conversation, but the thing that really struck me in that moment was when I reminded myself that Robbie, my missing person, had been a passionate and dedicated boxer. I simply cannot overstate how much of a rush it is when it seems like a lead is coming together like that. And again, it proved how right Robbie's mum really was to be concerned about him. Her son and this Tony bloke were now connected in two ways, and considering the kind of esteem people held in him, I realized just how much of a balls up the police had made in not following up the lead. So as I'm sipping my pint, I start making comments on the boxer's form, on their striking ability, stuff like that. I'm not directly addressing the Tony character, I'm just invoking that ancient publican tradition of talking loudly until someone joins in the conversation. It probably sounds a bit mental now that I've typed it out like that, but it worked. And before long, me and Tony were having a bit of sporadic back and forth. I introduced myself, not offering up my real name but a variation on it, then bought him a pint when I'd finished off my own. He asked how I knew so much about boxing, and I told him another variation on the truth when I said that I used to help a friend train for fights back when I was in the Navy. It turns out he, too, was an amateur boxer back in the day, and he retained a huge passion for it throughout his life. He then asked what I was doing out in Crossley, and I gave him the whole sob story about being freshly and bitterly divorced. Tony looked fairly disinterested by the end of my explanation, so, in an attempt to keep his interest, I asked him if he ever bet on matches, what with him knowing so much about boxing. He made a bit of a face and then said something like, "That rubbish? No, not anymore." To keep the conversation going, I made out that I used to be quite a big-time gambler before I got married, and that I was planning on getting back into it now that the wife didn't have a grip on my finances. He sort of rolled his eyes, but he was still with me when I asked him if he had any tips or anything, like any talented young boxers that he might know of. He then told me that the best piece of advice he could ever give me was not to gamble on professional boxing at all. According to him, it was all rigged. The refs were all paid off, the fighters all took dives and were working from scripts, all to funnel money into the hands of the bookies. Maybe it's the cynic in me, but I can't say I didn't agree with him a wee bit. So I asked him a very genuine question, and quizzed him on what combat sports were fit to bet on. He just sort of looked off at the telly for a while, not saying anything, then got this very sinister look about him. Tony was smiling, but he had this look in his eye. This wolfish, almost bloodthirsty look. He started telling me about these small-time kickboxing fights in Thailand that he'd been to, and how, if he knew the sport, you could win thousands of US dollars a night betting on these tiny 100-person spectator events on the outskirts of Bangkok. He said big fighters just do it for the money, but the smaller up-and-coming lads who put way more emphasis on honor and skill, they quite literally fight for their lives. A few wins in the lower divisions could mean getting their names on bigger and better cards, and the money they earn could end up catapulting their families out of poverty. That, according to Tony, was the purest form of fighting there was. Everything else was just theater. He seemed to know an awful lot about boxing, outside of the actual sport. He knew about the gambling side, but he seemed to know a wee bit about the promotional side, too. I then asked what he did for a living, as in, if he was involved in that promotional side or if he ran a gym or anything. He said he visited a gym, which was only too obvious from the looks of him, but that he hadn't been involved in organizing events for years and years. According to him, it was a lot of stress, not too much money, and then added, "I'll stick to the side of the TV screen, thank you very much." I took two things away from this part of our conversation. Number one, Tony didn't answer my question, in that he danced around telling me what he did for a living. And number two, he was lying. I know it's a bit of a detective story cliche at this point, but you really do get a sense of when people are lying to you. And when Tony told me that he hadn't been involved in boxing promotions for years and years, I knew that wasn't true. Everything else he told me was correct, but that part wasn't. He was still involved in some capacity, he just didn't feel comfortable telling a stranger, which to me was basically like striking oil. I had my number one person of interest, connected to my missing person in more than one facet, and not only did I have a strong suspicion that he was lying to me, but I was 90% sure that he was involved in some kind of organized crime. Robbie needed money to move into Glasgow, and if Tony was involved in loan sharking, then that might well account for his disappearance. And by that, I don't mean like when he couldn't pay, they rolled him up into a carpet and chucked him in a lock. I mean, a lot of people get themselves into debt, then just voluntarily disappear, mainly because they're so afraid of the previously mentioned carpets. People do it with big banks, too. They try all sorts of scams. They disappear, change their names, even fake their own deaths. So when some big former boxer is threatening to break your legs if you don't get his money to him on time, voluntary disappearances are surprisingly likely. I wasn't 100% certain that Tony was loan-sharking, but I wasn't about to ask him during that first conversation. When you're working with a cover story, those first contacts are all about winning trust. Push too hard, and you push them away. I had to wait until the next day to see Tony again, but when I did, I had a plan waiting. I told him that I'd love to buy him a pint, but I was skint. My soon-to-be ex-wife wouldn't let me into our joint account because we'd already signed the divorce papers, so until I could sell off some possessions, I was brassic. Any loan shark worth his salt would have seen that as a clear business opportunity, but all Tony did was offer his sympathies before offering to buy me a pint instead. I accepted his offer, quietly taken aback that my loan shark theory had potentially been rolled out. Then I asked him if he just so happened to know anyone who might be interested in lending me a bit of short-term cash. Again, he shook his head and told me that he didn't know anyone who could help me. But then after a pause, he asked me, "Have you definitely got some money coming in on Friday?" It was a very loaded question, but the thing that really got my attention was how Tony suddenly seemed to have a bit of that wolfish look about him, like the one he had earlier. I told him that yes, I definitely had some money coming in that Friday, which, by that point, was only the day after next. He then asked me, "You definitely know your boxing, eh? Enough to put money on it?" Again, I told him yes, I knew my boxing, and most definitely enough to put a few quid on. At which point, Tony's gaze became very intense. He looked me over for a few moments, then told me if I wanted to make enough money to last me a good few years, be in the pub at closing on Saturday night with a couple of grand in cash. And at that, he finished off his pint of Guinness and said his goodbyes, and then walked out of the pub. I immediately informed my bosses that I had a huge potential lead regarding a person of interest, and then told Robbie's parents that their suspicions regarding the mysterious Tony character had most definitely been warranted. The only problem was, I had no physical evidence that Tony's criminality was connected to Robbie's disappearance, only strong suspicions. We knew Robbie needed money. That was the only reason he was working in the pub. It was a stepping stone to something greater. So what if Tony had been the one to offer it to him via some kind of illicit gambling operation? Robbie could have gotten in too deep, made a bet that he couldn't honor, or he could have threatened to expose Tony's criminality after being duped out of his wages. There were a ton of possibilities, but like I said, I didn't have evidence for any of them. However, what I did have was a golden opportunity to gather said evidence by meeting Tony back at the pub come closing time on Saturday. I didn't have any kind of secret or hidden cameras I could use, but I did have one of those small old-fashioned dictation machines that I could place in the chest pocket of my jacket. That way I could record any conversations we had and potentially obtain audio that would be of huge interest to the police. And that was the only surefire method that we had to get the investigation into Robbie's disappearance back on track and to make sure that it was headed in the right direction. It was an exciting moment. The first time in my career that I felt like a proper secret agent. But unfortunately for me, that midnight meeting would result in my second brush with almost certain death. As instructed, I made sure that I was at the pub before closing time on Saturday night. It was a nervous wait, but eventually Tony showed up. However, instead of coming inside and sitting down at the bar like he usually did, he just caught my attention from the doorway and then beckoned me to follow him. I walked out of the pub with Tony to my front, and as we walked to his car, he turned his back to me, giving me the perfect opportunity to reach into my chest pocket and switch on my dictation machine. The tapes were tiny, and only had about 45 minutes worth of recording time to them, but there'd be no switching it on in his car without raising suspicion, and he had eyes on me as we walked out of the pub, so I had to do it there and then, or not do it at all. As we walked to his car, I saw two blokes sitting in the back seat of a gray Mercedes. I'll be honest, this did ring some alarm bells. But there was also a chance that, wherever we were going to gamble my cash, Tony thought it best to take some muscle with him. So I walk over to his car, climbed into the passenger seat after giving the heavies in the back a nervous greeting, and then off we went towards our mystery destination. Obviously, first question I had for Tony was, where are we going? He gave me one of those wolfish smiles and told me, you'll see. We kept on driving for a minute or two, and since I didn't know the area very well, I had no clue where he was taking us. And then after the silence got a bit too uncomfortable, I asked him, are we going to bet on a boxing match? And he told me, could be, and then asked if I had it on me, assuming he meant the cash. I lied and told him I did, patting a bulge in my jacket pocket that had a pair of rolled-up socks in it. Not exactly a Hollywood prop, but little bluffs like that can be very effective. I then asked him what kind of fight we were going to. Tony paused before speaking and then asked if I remembered what he said about these Muay Thai fights in Thailand. I remembered exactly what he'd said about those young, hungry fighters and how ferociously they fought. Tony had also mentioned that some of those fights were unsanctioned events, sometimes organized between towns or villages. Your best fighter versus ours, for honor, glory, and untold riches for those with the stones to risk their hard-earned money. And that's when it clicked. Tony wasn't taking me to a boxing match he knew was rigged. He was taking me to an unsanctioned, illegal boxing match that he had organized himself. I had to remind myself that I was recording the whole conversation, and since he was feeling talkative, I decided to ask some much more direct questions. I remember asking him with a sort of feigned horror, it's not going to be bare knuckle, is it? Tony didn't say anything. He just nodded. I then asked if the fighters ever got hurt. He told me, combat sports can be dangerous. Sometimes people go down and they don't get back up again. Sad fact. And it was my turn to stay quiet. Not so much because of the brutal honesty behind Tony's words, but because I suddenly realized what had happened to the missing Robbie. A clean-cut, square-go lad like him would never have gambled his wages away. But what he might have done is accept an offer to fight in one of those matches if it meant walking away with a king's ransom and prize money, enough to move to Glasgow, enough to kickstart his dream sooner rather than later. I thought I had the perfect opportunity to ask, and considering what Tony had just said, I felt like I was on the cusp of him admitting to being involved in Robbie's disappearance. But when I asked him if anyone had died in the ring recently, he told me, I think that's enough questions for now, don't you? And right as he said that, I started to recognize some of the buildings we were passing, but they didn't make any sense at all. They would have meant that Tony had just driven us round in circles for maybe 10 to 15 minutes, only for us to end up right back where we started. I asked Tony again, where are you taking me? And once again he told me, you'll see. And seconds later, we pulled up outside a building that I recognized in an instant. It was the B&B that I'd been staying in. We sat there in the car for a second, before Tony slowly turned in his seat to look at me. I kept up the act for as long as I could, asking if he was pulling some kind of wind-up on me, and his response made my blood run cold. We know who you are. I was scared, but I knew from my training that I had to stick to my story no matter what. I told him I had no idea what he was talking about, that I was exactly who I said I was. But it was no good. I was still trying to reason with him when one of the fellas in the back seat reached over my shoulder, grabbed the dictation machine out of my pocket, and then held it up for Tony to see. He took it and then asked me, how many more of these have you got? And the heavy in the back seat must have seen me fiddling with something in my jacket pocket as I walked to the car. But at the time, all I was thinking in my fear-addled mind was, how the hell did they know? Seeing as it was most likely pointless, I decided to stop lying and told Tony that the dictation machine was the only one I had with me. He then told me that we were going up to my room to have a chat, and that if I said a word to anyone in the B&B, anyone who might be awake at that time, then he'd burn the whole place down with me in it. We went up to my room, and while Tony's heavies ransacked the place, it was very surreal seeing them do it quietly. He told me to take a seat on the bed. Apparently he and his boys had decided to do a bit of research on me before they committed to taking me to an illegal fight. And whoever Tony was connected to was a lot more capable and powerful than I could ever imagine.
Tony started explaining that I'd caused him an awful lot of trouble. His routines would have to change. He wouldn't be able to go to the pub anymore, all because he knew he couldn't trust me not to tell my bosses everything. He said he might not have been able to stop me talking in the past, but he'd certainly be able to stop me from talking in the future. And at that, one of his heavies pulled out a length of electrical cord from his jacket pocket. As the guy started to fashion an improvised noose from the cord, Tony explained that killing me would bring a lot of unnecessary attention down on him and his business partners. But faking a scene where I had ended my own life, that would cause a lot less of a fuss. I remember him saying something like, "A lot of ex-squatties end up that way. No one would bat an F an eyelid if they'd found you hanging in a cupboard, would they?" I can't overstate just how chilling that was, knowing that Tony and his partners somehow had access to my service records. But ironically, it was that little detail that may well have ended up saving my life. Back when I was in Northern Ireland, one of my section's Land Rovers was caught in an IRA ambush near a place called Crossmaglen. I was wounded as we fought our way out of it, but two of my section mates lost their lives. The injuries I sustained resulted in my eventual discharge from the army, and apparently, Tony had read all about it. He'd been ready to have me killed. He'd been ready to fake a tragic, self-inflicted end. But after reading about the incident in which I'd received a mention in dispatches, he decided it was bad form to kill someone who'd already cheated death once. He gave me some big speech about how we were both soldiers, and in war, honorable soldiers don't just kill each other when the battle ends. The winners and the losers come to an agreement, and according to Tony, that's exactly what we were going to do. We didn't so much come to an agreement as Tony imposed terms. The only reason he'd mentioned young boxers getting killed in those illegal fights was that he accepted certain people deserved to know what happened to their missing family members. They needed to accept that their loved ones weren't coming back, so that their hearts could mend, and they could move on with their lives. But that, said Tony, was all I was ever going to get out of him, and if any of my colleagues decided to visit Crossley in the future, it was me that was going to pay the price. Tony and his boys didn't just know about my service record and who I worked for, they knew where my mom lived. Any further attempts to interfere with their operation, and it'd be her that ended up hanging in a cupboard, with a wee note saying that she couldn't stand the arthritic pain anymore. And that was obviously the bit which terrified me most, the idea that he might hurt my own mother. But the thing that really broke me was the fact that he knew her name, where she lived, and he knew about the medical condition she'd been struggling with for the better part of a decade. And even as someone who was immersed in the world of information retrieval, I was astounded at how Tony had been able to get his hands on all of that information in just a few short days. That's round about the time that I realized Tony couldn't have been running the illegal boxing ring on his own. He must have had some very wealthy and very powerful partners to get his hands on all my personal information so fast. For all I know, they hired one of AIS's competitors, which, let me tell you, would have set them back an astonishing amount of money if they wanted to get their info in that kind of time frame. Then, after we shook on our little agreement, Tony and his heavies left me in a ransacked bedroom, having taken all my notebooks and dictation tapes with them. I left Crossley, with my tail between my legs, having been dramatically and unexpectedly outmatched. I told my bosses everything, that I'd been compromised, that my family was at risk, and to their credit, they made arrangements to ensure their safety. But more importantly to me, I told Robbie's parents everything too. That hadn't been part of the deal between me and Tony, as I think he knew good and well that it was a term that I'd never accept. I told them that, although I had no evidence of it, I knew for certain that Robbie had been manipulated into taking part in an underground boxing match. And I also told them that there was a very good chance that Robbie had sustained fatal injuries during one of those fights, and that the event's organizers had then covered up his death. In all probability, his body would never be found, and his killers would never be brought to justice. And even with all the information I was able to forward to the police, Tony would be on the run, knowing full well that his part in the operation had been compromised. I apologized to Robbie's parents, over and over again, for not being able to bring their son home. But they showed patience and strength of spirit, and that was the closest evidence I've come across for there being a big man upstairs. They told me what I'd done was enough, that I'd brought them more answers and more closure than the police had in almost a year of investigating. It didn't matter to them that Robbie's killers mightn't face justice in life because, in their opinion, the justice they'd face in the great thereafter would be far greater than anything they'd have to suffer on Earth. I think the worst investigation I ever worked on seemed like your basic proof of infidelity job at first. We got a call from a client who thought his wife was cheating on him with the guy she worked with. He was away on business a lot, and he'd had his suspicions for some time, but to get solid evidence, he called us. I guess some of you might be asking, why not just set up nanny cams or go through her phone to find the receipts? Well, there's a very simple explanation for that. Digital literacy. The client was in his 60s, but his wife was in her 20s. He knew she was cheating, but he just couldn't get that clean break divorce without evidence of prenup breaking infidelity, and when it came to getting a hold of that evidence, his wife always seemed to be two steps ahead. He said that when he first suspected his wife of having her boyfriend over to their place, he installed nanny cams to try and catch them in the act. And then somehow, they figured out the cameras were there and just changed the venues so they wouldn't get caught. Next thing, he tries stealing her phone, thinking he'd have time to guess the password and go through her emails and whatnot. She had it bricked before he even got a chance to try, and some tech kid wanted four figures to break past the security to retrieve all the data stored on the thing. We only asked him for half the figure to get his photographic evidence of an intimate rendezvous. Nothing salacious, of course, but incriminating enough to get him that swift and uncostly divorce he wanted so bad. The wife wasn't dumb. She stayed away from her boyfriend while hubby was in town. But you know what they say, when the cat's away, the mice will play. So to help catch her, hubby plans a fake business trip but doesn't even leave the city, stays in this nice hotel downtown. He then pays us to tail his wife while demanding updates every 5 minutes. And so that was me for 5 nights of my life, following this broad and her boyfriend around the city while my partner sat in the passenger seat taking pictures wherever they went. Every night, he'd take her out to his condo in the suburbs, then every morning, he'd drive her back home. They had no clue that they were being followed, especially at night when it was dark and the places they went were high traffic. I was on the night team, 8 p.m. till 8 a.m., and since the boyfriend drove the target back home so early, my partner and I would be there to see it, bleary-eyed and wired on Dunkin' coffees. But then this one morning, Loverboy came out all alone, looking like he hadn't slept a wink all night, but was somehow headed to the gym all bright and early. Guy had a hoodie and shorts on, then after tossing a very full-looking gym bag into the trunk of his car, he took off. At first, my partner and I are all jokes. I woke him up, pointed to our guy, then probably made some inappropriate joke about how he and the client's wife had been up all night. Obviously, we recognized that this was slightly a different routine for them, but the significance of it was totally lost on us until much later that day. Like I said, my partner and I were on night duties, so maybe an hour or so after spotting our red-eyed lover boy walking out of his condo alone, we handed over to the day team. We went home, got some sleep, then once we were ready to go again, I got in touch with the day team to find out where they were so we could switch over. To my amazement, they were still parked outside of Loverboy's condo. He hadn't returned home from work, and as far as they knew, our client's wife hadn't left the condo either. Our day team figured the pair of them had a heavy night of drinking and dancing, among other things, but then by the time 8 p.m. came around and neither the wife nor her boyfriend had been spotted, they started to wonder if something was going on. They told us all that, but granted, it was only maybe 8 p.m. at the time. The wife could have been lying in bed all day, stuffing her face with cheese doodles while her boyfriend was off doing whatever. I remember telling my partner, $20 says he's back before dark. Guy must be running on fumes already. And a few hours later, I was handing over that 20, still looking at the guy's empty parking spot. We didn't have anything else to do but sit there in our car, watching the condo and any signs of the wife. She was our follow, not her boyfriend, and If at any point we felt like we needed to track him to find her, then we'd deal with that situation as we came to it. So for the second night in a row, we sat outside Loverboy's condo, bored out of our skulls. Then, since we were almost constantly in touch with the client, and we were obliged to be frank regarding the status of our investigation, we had to level with them. There had been no sign of his wife or her boyfriend for 24 hours, give or take. Any longer, and we'd have to consider the possibility that they knew that they were being followed and given us the slip. The client basically told us, "Okay, keep me updated," and then left us to do our thing. We waited all night, but still, there was no sign of either the target or her boyfriend. So by that point, we're thinking the wife had tricked us into waiting there while she snuck out a back door or something. We called our boss, and he agreed that we should go check out the client's home to see if there was any activity there. You know, like a bedroom or hallway light on, any indicator that she'd gone back there instead. There was no sign of anyone there, but soon after, it was no longer our problem. The day team took over for the next 12 hours, and it was our turn to get some well-deserved rest. Then, come 8 p.m., and our handover, we learned that there had been no activity at the client's house, but no activity at the boyfriend's condo either. The day team had tried a bunch of other places too, all regular hangouts of Loverboy and our client's wife, but there was no sign of them there either. That meant 36 hours of no contact, which is not what our clients pay us for. But then right as we're trying to think of a way to get back on track, we get a call from our boss. The client had reached out with some real concerning news. His wife had been due to meet a friend for a dinner date, but hadn't showed. Equally concerned, her friend had called her husband, our client, saying that she hadn't texted over any kind of cancellation and wasn't answering any calls either. Obviously, the loss of contact was concerning, but having one of her friends being on the verge of reporting her missing, that suggested a whole other level of urgency was required. We had to make sure that she wasn't still in Loverboy's condo. The only question was, how? Since it was only a few minutes past 9, I figured that I might be able to catch the building superintendent so I could run an old scam on them and try to get a look inside the room. I told my partner to stay put, got out of the car, then just walked right up to the apartment building and tried to open the door. To my luck, and his misfortune, they had the poor superintendent guy doubling as security, so as soon as I started loudly trying to open the door without a key, he came running to see who I was. I started explaining that I was looking for a friend of mine, how I hadn't seen him in a few days and how I was worried about him. The guy started giving me all that, "I can't let you in without prior permission." But I turned the Hollywood up to 11 and started giving the guy this whole sob story about how he'd recently been diagnosed with cancer and was taking it real hard. That and his mom was in the hospital with a busted hip, having fallen down the stairs when she heard the news and fainted. I laid it on thick for the guy, said whatever tear-jerking thing came to mind, and in the end, he agreed to show me into Loverboy's apartment, so long as it was under his strict supervision. Mission accomplished, right? If the wife was in there, I could say that I was mistaken and that I must have given the wrong address. Sure, that was getting a little too close to the target for comfort, but these weren't your regular circumstances anymore. The client wasn't just concerned for his wife's fidelity anymore. He had a bad feeling that she might have stolen a bunch of jewelry from him, then ran off with Loverboy after losing their tail. He hadn't told us that was a possibility before, but when he did, it made the situation time-critical, so to speak. Anyway, we head up the stairs to the second floor, and the guy lets me into the condo that we've been staking out. He opens the door for me, reminding me that he's about to tail me everywhere, then off we go into the TV room, the kitchen, and eventually the bedroom. I went to open it, and found the door was locked. I call out, not specifically to the wife, just to anybody, but no one replies. The guy then starts saying how no one's home, but I start explaining how we definitely need to get that bedroom door open because I'm scared that my buddy has done something terrible, either to himself or someone else. He says he doesn't have the keys to the doors inside of these units, which was understandable, but then as he was talking, he suddenly stops. His eyes go wide, and he points down at my hand. There was blood, like old half-dried stuff smeared across my lower fingers and palm all from where I'd gripped the door handle. And my adrenaline starts pumping, I tell the guy to call the cops because either they're going to have to arrest me for criminal damage or they're going to want to see whatever the hell was behind that locked bedroom door. I knew I'd have to stay anyway. I had friggin' forensics all over my hands, so when the guy agreed to go get the cops, I just hung out in the hallway outside and called my partner to let him know things had taken a real dark turn up there. We suspected the worst, but having it confirmed didn't make it any easier. The cops arrived with the whole team. They got the bedroom door open and there she was, lying on the floor, strangled. We didn't find out until much later on, but the wife had actually tried to break it off with Loverboy after a night on the town. She thought one last blowout would soften the blow. But after too many cocktails, the guy wasn't anywhere near as level-headed as she figured he might be, and somehow, he came to the decision that if he couldn't have her, no one could. That morning when we saw him, wearing his workout gear and looking like he hadn't slept, he'd murdered our client's wife less than an hour before. We were sat there in our car, having no clue that a murder was happening less than 100 yards away. It makes me sick to think about, even all these years later, knowing that we were so close, but there was nothing we could have done to stop it. I heard Loverboy went to prison for first-degree murder and that the rich client remarried not long after. And I have a ton of stories from my time as a PI, but that's by far the one that haunts me the most. I was a private detective in Michigan for 4 years following a long career in law enforcement. And ironically, it was during what was intended to be 4 short, quiet years that I encountered my most frightening and disturbing case. Our agency received a call from a woman who suspected her husband of having an affair. She said that she knew he was lying when he claimed to be working late, but essentially said that she couldn't deal with the emotional stress of personally uncovering the affair, if one was indeed taking place. And that's where I came in. If the client's husband was engaged in an extramarital affair, then it was my job to compile as much photographic evidence as possible before presenting said evidence to the client. On the surface, it was pretty standard PI work, the kind of thing that makes up about 30-40% of all of our time. But in actual fact, it was one of the most disturbing and mystifying events of my entire career. So as I've already touched on, the client had already done some of the preliminary work herself. She was fine with him working late, and at first, she was proud of him for sacrificing his time for the good of their children. But her real suspicions began when their rather active love life petered out before dropping off completely. Her husband then started to act increasingly withdrawn and seemed disinterested in pretty much anything that wasn't work-related. She said that she tried talking to him, but he just brushed the whole thing off like she was simply imagining things. Then, an accident where he'd proven a little overprotective of his cell phone provided to be the final straw, as in the client's husband seemed to descend into a minor panic at the prospect of her gaining unfettered access to it. Since she couldn't gain access to any of his devices, she decided to check in with his place of work to see if he really was working late. When she found out that was a lie, she attempted to follow him one evening after he clocked out of work, but when she saw him driving toward the city limits, she didn't have the nerve to follow him. Her husband didn't work late every night, so we had to wait for a call from the client. But when we did, I got into position and then tailed him after he got out of work at around 5:30. Just like his wife had said, he drove for miles towards the city limits and then drove a few more miles out into the country before turning down a dirt road. I didn't immediately follow him. That's not something you'd ever do during a covert pursuit, not unless it was a life-or-death kind of situation. If the dirt road had a dead end, I could possibly give myself away, so the thing to do was to keep going, pull over, and then use Google Maps to take a look where the road led to. According to Google, the dirt road led to two places, the first being the next stretch of highway over, and the other being some kind of industrial facility. At first, I figured the whole job had been a complete false alarm, because if he was driving out to some industrial site, it was most likely work-related, right? But just to be certain, I started looking into the company that owned the site and how it might be related to the husband's employment, figuring I might as well since I was pulled over and had my phone in hand. I saw that the site in question, according to Google, was permanently closed. And while that didn't mean the husband was there for legitimate reasons, it did raise my suspicions a little. So instead of just sitting there and peering at satellite images from 2013, I decided to double back, turn down the dirt road I'd seen the husband go down, and then go check out the industrial compound for myself. I pull up outside the gates, only to see a very derelict-looking place, all rusted shipping containers and falling down warehouses. Again, it didn't preclude the possibility that the husband was professionally involved in some way, but I still didn't know if he was actually there. I couldn't see his car, and for all I knew, he'd carried on down the dirt road to that other stretch of highway. I'd have to tail him again to get a concrete idea of where he was going, but luckily, that's exactly where the guy was headed. Next time, I tailed him and he turned down the dirt road, and I followed at a distance. Then, when we got to the chained-up gates of the derelict industrial compound, the husband stopped his car and then got out just as I rolled past him. I could see him watching me out of my rear view, just standing next to his car, still as a statue, and he waited until I was way down the dirt track before he moved again. I managed to hover at the very end of the track long enough, where it bent the highway, that I caught a glimpse of the client's husband driving his car into the derelict industrial complex. Then when I circled back to take a look, the chain on the compound's gate had been locked again, but when I peered past its iron bars, there was no parked cars anywhere to be seen. I did a brief check of the fencing around the compound and found it all so rusted and dilapidated that breaking in would be relatively easy. Obviously, we were in touch with the client at every stage of the investigation, but as you can probably guess, she wanted to know what was in that compound just as much as I did. Or more accurately, she wanted to know what her husband was doing there if he wasn't working in some capacity. The client was still insistent on getting conclusive evidence, or at least proving once and for all that her husband wasn't being unfaithful. As a private detective, I had something of an advantage in this situation. When I was a cop, there was no way that I could just force my way onto private property like that, not unless I could handle the whole heap of trouble that would be headed my way if I was caught doing so. But as a PI, the worst thing that could happen, on the legal side of things anyways, would be getting trespassing by some cops. This obviously gave me a lot more operational maneuverability and meant that I could get into the compound and finish the job without having to worry about getting my ass fired. I didn't try and break into the compound until I'd received implicit instructions from the client. After all, a risk was still a risk, and I didn't want to take one unless I absolutely had to. But once we got the okay and a call saying the husband was working late again, I readied myself to collect the conclusive proof that the client was paying us for. I repeated the process of following the husband from his place of work to the abandoned industrial site. But then, instead of immediately following him to his apparent destination, I continued down the highway for around 10 to 15 minutes before doubling back towards the site. Whatever he was doing, and whoever he was doing it with, I wanted to catch them in the act, you know? Not walk in on them setting up or just talking or whatever and potentially jeopardize the entire investigation. It'd be a delicate operation, but it also perfectly illustrates why I was so reluctant to let go of my vocation even after the standard retirement age. While many of my peers were content to move down to Florida Keys and spend their twilight years just fishing, I knew right from the second I even heard the word retirement that I'd miss the adrenaline rush that came with the sharp edge of detective work. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I was actually pumped to break into that site, track down my target, and catch him in the act. Not so much out of any ill feeling towards him, I just wanted to get to the bottom of this mystery. As I said, I waited around 20 to 30 minutes before parking my car on the dirt road, and then I searched for the weaker section of the fence that I'd spotted on my first time around. Then after getting inside, and armed with a flashlight, a video camera, and my 9mm, I set about searching the derelict industrial site for any sign of the client's husband. The place was huge, blocks and blocks of old warehouses and what appeared to be abandoned manufacturing facilities. but the gaps between them were wide enough to drive a vehicle down, and eventually I came across a group of them, all parked outside of this one gray stone building that looked different from the others. At this point, I switched on the video camera, making sure to get a shot of the husband's vehicle along with its plate. But just as I got the shot, I started to hear something. Real faint at first, but it got louder and louder as I approached the building. It was the sound of something crying out, and what sounded like pain. But it sounded muffled, too, like either they were gagged or someone was covering their mouth with a hand. At that point, I slid my flashlight back into the holster on my belt and then grabbed my pistol instead. My heart rate was beginning to pick up, and although I wouldn't say that I was scared, I was extremely apprehensive. Like I said earlier, I thought the job was going to be your basic tail 'em and tape 'em kind of deal. So to hear those screams was to realize that this wasn't your basic PI work at all. This was something different. I remember creeping towards the front doors to the big concrete building and thinking to myself, this is a real dumb idea. There was a good chance that I'd be outnumbered and possibly outgunned too, God forbid. But the prospect of abandoning whoever was in there screaming, that was something I couldn't allow myself to do. I guess more out of practice than principle, but still, I couldn't just walk away. So I opened up the door, crept inside, and carried on walking very gently towards the source of the screaming, which appeared to be inside a room down a dusty, dark corridor. And there was a pattern to it, too. The screams would start up, these skin-crawling growls and yelps, and then they'd die off again. In between the screams, I'd heard voices, some laughing, some talking, and then the screams would start up again, just as loud as before. I got closer and closer until eventually I'm right outside the room the screams are coming from. I took a breath, made sure my pistol was locked and loaded, and then burst into the room. Only to be greeted by something that looked like a scene from a horror movie. Surrounded by 5 men, a 6th had been tied to a chair, and by the looks of things, they had been taking turns torturing him. He's been stripped to his underwear, had blood dripping from various cuts to his arms and legs, and there were also what looked like burn marks all over his body. First thing I yelled was, "State police, don't move," and that worked like a charm initially. I directed everyone who wasn't tied to a chair to stand facing the wall, except one, who I ordered to untie the victim. I told him not to look at me, but he didn't listen, and the second he saw my video camera, he knew that I wasn't with the cops. I mean, what kind of state cop works alone while carrying a goddamn video camera of all things? He might have figured out who I wasn't, but then again, I wasn't the one with the gun pointed in their face. The guy frees the captive victim from the chair, who's still gagged and can barely walk. They're mumbling something under their gag, something at the time I figured was either thank you or some variation on that, but I told them to save it until we were actually in the free and clear. The last thing I told those sadistic strangers was that they should stay put, because anyone who came chasing after me would most likely be shot by my backup officers who were currently rushing to the scene. It was a total bluff, but only one of them knew it for certain, and he appeared to have way more sense than I gave him credit for, because he stayed put with his buddies and opted not to get shot. All I remember feeling is relief that the group weren't heavily armed, or that a shootout hadn't erupted as soon as I'd stormed the room they occupied. I still had no idea what was going on at that point, but I knew it was some majorly bad juju, and almost certainly the doing of some organized crime group, which meant that I wanted to get the hell out of there with the victim as fast as humanly possible. I got them to a hospital. They stayed with him until the cops showed up so I could give a statement on what had happened, and after that, it was time to talk to the client about what I'd seen, which I can assure you was not an easy process. I guess no one wants to find out that their spouse had been taking part in the brutal torture of another human being, and that they're better off talking to a defense attorney as opposed to the divorce kind. But in this case, the client took it particularly badly. After that, she no longer desired to retain our services, so we parted ways after sending her a bill. I guess the reason that this one stays with me so much is not because I walked in on something so horrible, it's because I have no idea why it was happening. To this day, I've never heard anything about any Michigan torture case. I don't even know if the husband ended up getting arrested. All I know is that taking that job meant that I was in that right place at the right time to save someone a whole world of life-changing torment. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 7 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, or over email at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and you might even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of this YouTube channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories and big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, no one sleeps in Australia.